Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Taylor Mackin.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Stone from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, the first podcast of 2016. We hope you have a very prosperous and healthy year in the year ahead. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And in this first podcast, we're just going to have a little look back, aren't we, John, on some of the events of the last year, because we never got a chance before Christmas to do so. But there were sort of obviously three major sporting events that come to mind. In fact, maybe four, in that we had the One Day Cricket World Cup, we had the Rugby World Cup, the Asian Cup, which was the Football Asian Cup that Australia hosted, and of course the Ashes as well. So it was quite a good year for sport.
Oh, it was a fantastic year for sport. How much happened? Just every week there was something more.
There was, and, you know, it was a few ups and downs also for Western Australian teams. But I was talking to someone the other day, and, I mean, the One Day Cricket World Cup, obviously Australia won it, New Zealand were in the final. But a few people were saying, how much future does it actually have? T20 seems to have really usurped it now. Nobody's really interested. And if you're going to have the shortened version of the game, one day now seems too long.
I've actually come to like One Day cricket more since the advent of T20 cricket. I mean, T20 cricket is, and you're seeing a lot more this season, stand and deliver. And there's no subtlety to it. There's just have a crack, you know. And some of these shots, these guys, the standard shot now is put your back foot back and across, open yourself up, put your front forward across, open yourself up, and you got the hole. It's almost baseball. In fact, if they took the stumps from the bowler's end and spread them out in a diamond, they wouldn't be too far away.
Look, I've got to be honest, I still have yet to watch a whole game of T20. it just doesn't excite me. The one bits I have watched, and I was talking to an ex-professional Australian player recently, and I was saying the thing that astounds me, though, is the bowlers, in that they do not vary it. They don't change their angles on the crease. They don't really bowl an out-and-out slower ball. They don't bowl. They're not able to bowl a Yorker as regularly. You take a bowler like Damien Fleming, who could put it in the block hole. They can't even do that. And I just think the standard of bowling in these games, sure, they're on a hiding to nothing, but they don't use their brains. They don't think the batsman out.
Well, there's a few guys that, I mean, Andrew Tyre, the local boy, he's a very good at that format bowler. He's a very good bowler because he does have that slow ball that no one can pick. But you're right, I see it. We saw the game the other day where the bloke hit the six off the third last ball or something, bring up the century, win the game, yee-haw. But what sort of delivery did he hit that off? It was above shoulder height. It would have been a no ball. What are you bowling that sort of delivery for at a guy who's absolutely on fire? As cricketers, we know the best way to stop a bloke from hitting a six is put it at his toes, because you can only hit a six if you can get under it.
Absolutely. Or bowl underarm, as the Kiwis were renowned for.
Kiwis? You're stirring it now, mate.
I am indeed.
But, I mean, I don't mind T20. I think it's good. It's just another form of the game. But my worries is that it bleeds into Test cricket. And we're seeing that. We're seeing blokes get out to just stupid shots.
But the thing that upset me with that is you have someone like Mark Taylor, who I actually respect quite a lot in what he did as a player and as a captain of Australia. He's now coming out backing a four-day test match. And it's only because these guys can't bat for 5 days anymore. Well, although, to be fair, the England-South Africa test match recently, I mean, there have been some fantastic innings in that where guys have been able to bat for a long time at the crease.
I'm more worried about the state of pitches that are being prepared. I mean, that says as much about the pitches as anything. These days, they're either over in 3 days or they get two innings in and make 700 each. It doesn't seem to be those sorts of pitches where there's a bit on the first day for the bowler, there's a bit on the last day for the bowlers, and it's, you know, day three, batsman's paradise.
Well, have you seen the rule they're bringing into the County Championship this year in 2016?
About the toss?
Yeah. There will be no toss. So the visiting team will bat first unless they choose not to, and then there will be a toss of the coin. And the idea of that is to do exactly what you're saying, take away the advantage of the pitch from the home side. Now, to me, again, that's ludicrous. If you have strong management, and if you look now, every single game has a match referee. So why doesn't the match referee go, this pitch is not a good cricket pitch? And let's be honest, all these guys have played. The match referees aren't nuffies like you and me. They are former international or top-level players. And they should just say, you're fined because the pitch wasn't good enough. And if you start or you deduct points from them because the pitch wasn't good enough, but to take away the toss and say you're batting first because you're bringing the gear or something like that.
See, I don't understand the arguments against it. Because when the toss is made, both captains know what the pitch is going to be like. Now, if you're the home side and you've set yourself up for a raging seamer on the first morning because you've got bowlers, well, you've got to hope you win that bloody toss, mate, because if you don't, it all goes downhill from there pretty quickly. So that there's still a 50, there's still percentage chances. Yeah. It's not a given that just because you make a green top, your bowlers are going to get first use of it.
So, I mean, this was the thing. I mean, Nottinghamshire back in the 80s were doing that. They had Clive Rice and Sir Richard Hadley. And, you know, at home, I think there was one season, I don't think they lost a game at home. But they still had to win away from home. And, I mean, so everyone was going, oh, it's because they won the games at home. Sure, but everybody knew what they were going to get there. So you pick your team accordingly.
Absolutely.
And I don't know. I don't think it actually has anything to do with it. As you say, it's all about preparing a good cricket wicket.
And let's face it, hometown advantage applied, or home field advantage, applies in just about every sport. It really does. And you even driving 5 kilometres from playing hockey at Fremantle to playing hockey at Melville, there's a huge home ground advantage there on the grass. And it's... I just don't understand why it would be such an issue that we have to get rid of the toss. It's part of the game. It's an integral part of the game, the toss. I would put it up there with like the bully in hockey, which I'm so sad went, because it's one thing everybody knew in hockey was the bully. People who never played the game or never watched it knew what hockey 1, hockey 2, hockey 3 was.
Trust me, the players today cannot do the bully.
Oh, I wouldn't.
See it when they have to do one in a game that they have no idea.
Well, even then they modified it. You only have to hit sticks once.
Yeah, but so it's just a shambles.
But the 50 over one day World Cup, I thought was a fantastic tournament, and it's a pity that the ICC have now decided that they're going to take places away from the Minnow Nations in that World Cup, because that provided some of the most entertaining cricket of the whole tournament.
I do think that the tournament has to be shorter. I do not see any reason why it has to go. I think it was 6-7 weeks.
No.
When you consider the first one was over in 2 weeks.
Is there any reason why cricketers can't play 3 one-day games in a week?
There shouldn't be. And we've discussed this before.
And that would be, I could see that would be a minimum. Why couldn't they play 4 one-day games in a week?
Absolutely. I mean, and if you look, some of the teams had 7 days off in that tournament between games. Mm. I think Sri Lanka had 8 between their first and second game. So, yeah, I'm not a fan of that. If we move on to the Rugby World Cup, well, you can understand why they have a week between games, because there were some bone-crunching games in that.
But even then, they managed to squeeze other games in. Every team had a game that was on a 4 or 5 day turnaround.
Correct.
So there was a level of fairness about the way that the draw was conducted. Okay, we understand, but we need to push it a little bit. And it gives all those guys who are in the squad but not first 15 members an opportunity to play. And imagine going to a World Cup and not getting out on the ground for one game.
And that's happened for a lot of players in various
Absolutely.
Sports.
Absolutely. I mean, it was a great experience and all that, they'll say, but deep down, they would be burning that they didn't get a chance to get out there.
I still think that more needs to be done to help those lesser nations close the gap. I mean, we saw obviously Japan beat South Africa. That was really the only one upset in the tournament, but it's the one everybody remembered. The one thing I thought that was brilliant, and it's maybe a lesson to be learnt for other tournaments in other sports, you don't always have to go to the massive stadiums or stadia to host games. They went to the provincial grounds like Gloucester, played at some of the football grounds, got packed houses. It wasn't the massive, massive numbers, but they managed to fill the ground and create tremendous atmosphere. And I think that there's a lesson in that for other sports.
Yeah, you don't need a huge crowd to have a huge reaction.
Yeah, I mean, if you look, if we were taking it here, you know, and Australia hosted the Rugby World Cup again, if you had, like, I think it was Samoa and Georgia played here in Western Australia, are they going to play at the 60,000 stadium that's being built, or would you play them at NIB, where you more than likely get a full house? I mean, I think you would play that game at NIB rather than the new stadium.
Well, you'd think so, but you know how organisers of these things like to go for the biggest and best available, and I'm not sure that Perth Stadium will be the best when it comes to rugby anyway.
Yeah, anyway, just on the Rugby World Cup, I think we have to say New Zealand, awesome performance of Richie McCaw.
Deserved.
What a leader he is. But also Michael Checker won the Coach of the Year, and what a turnaround he managed to effect on the Wallabies.
And it could have got, Australia could have won that game. I mean, they had their chances, and New Zealand just too good on the day. The way I think he connects with the players, there's obviously something that the players react to in him that they're prepared to give more than they have some other guys.
I still think the injury to Matt Gitto was the turning point in the game. I think had he possibly still been on the pitch, as you say, it would have been closer, or Australia may well have got very close to getting over the All Blacks. But that injury for concussion, to me, that was the turning point in the game.
I think one of Richie McCaw's greatest strengths of his game too is being able to make himself invisible just as the referee's looking at where he is. He's got this amazing ability to be invisible, has Richie? He's a great player. I don't want to make it sound like I'm whinging about him or anything.
But did you see at the press conference where he actually announced his retirement, they asked, one of the journalists asked him for his three favourite games or most important games, and he went back to the quarterfinal in 2007 where the All Blacks lost to France. And everyone was like, but he goes, because I learnt more from that game. And he goes, we would never have won in 2011 and 2015 if we hadn't have had that game.
And finally, New Zealand get that monkey off. Never won one outside of their home country. I think that was very important for them.
But also the first team in Rugby World Cup history to win back-to-back titles. No one had ever done it before.
Have they got the depth to continue?
We'll have to wait and see, won't we? I mean, everyone's written them off in the past. I reckon they may have a lean year this year, but you can rest assured in 18 months, 2 years, they'll be back up there.
Yeah, I got a feeling that there's another Dan Carter in the wings. There's another Richie McCaw.
There's plenty of players, I think, knocking on the door.
And we must, at this, while we're talking rugby, the sad passing of Jonah Lomu, one of the greats of world rugby. I mean, in some ways, it wasn't surprising. We've known that he's been ill for a long time, and that's not a disease that's going to let you go quickly.
Reckon it was DVT in the end, wasn't it? But it was obviously all related.
It's all related.
And but yeah, it was tragic. I mean, when I heard the news, I just couldn't believe it.
And the fact that he died penniless, I must admit, that surprised me more than the fact he'd passed away. But then again, everything everybody says about Jonah Lomu was he was a very generous man, and maybe he just gave it all away.
I think the sad thing was when he had Phil Kingsley-Jones as his manager, he was looking after him. And I believe his second wife was also very good at looking after the finances. But it was then when that partnership broke down, things went awry financially for poor Jonah.
Yeah, it's not the Lone Ranger there, Jonah, unfortunately.
No. So very, very sad. And I mean, of course, Jerry Collins also earlier in the year, we lost him as well. So New Zealand rugby lost two really great names.
Hi, I'm Mark Leduca and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
But we should move on from the rugby and do a bit of Asian Cup.
Yeah. Oh, well, it was a fantastic win for Australia, and I don't want to take anything away from that. Ange Postecoglou did an outstanding job. Let's not forget, though, 4 years before they'd made the final and they lost in extra time to Japan. But I still think that as a tournament, and I was having this argument over Christmas with someone, I think we have to put it in perspective in that there were really only four teams that were ever likely to win the tournament. And when you put it on a par with the other confederation tournaments around the world, it is a long, long way down. And I think that a lot of people, yes, it was a great win. Yes, it was a great event. But we have to put it in perspective. It doesn't mean Australia are up there with the top teams in the world. They've still got a long, long way to go, but it was a great victory.
Oh, yeah, I think so. It was much needed for football in this country, that's for sure. I mean, if they hadn't have got to the final, people would have been sticking the daggers in left, right and centre.
But if you look, they've struggled in the World Cup qualifying since, and yeah. I think that shows that it's, you know, they're maybe not quite as good as they think. What worries me is we're still really hanging on to Tim Cahill. He is the answer to all our prayers that if we are not winning a game, Tim Cahill will score us a goal. Now, he has done on a lot of occasions, but he's got old legs. And what you're going to see when it gets to a crunch game, and you look in 2016, someone will nobble him. Some player will take a yellow card to put him out of the game, because if that's all Australia have got, they will eliminate him.
I think, yeah, along your lines, my concern isn't that he gets picked and he played. It's that he's the only one like him that we can pick. He's the only choice.
Yeah.
And it's not as if, oh, well, Tim got the nod because he's a bit more experienced and blah, blah, and this other guy will come. It's just there's no one else like Tim Cahill. I think there's a lot of people that are probably looking at, is it Aaron Moy from Melbourne? They're probably, oh, well, he can be our next Tim, you know. He'll go to Europe again and he'll do this and do that.
But look, he's a good player again, and he has been for a long time. But let's not forget, he went over to Europe as a 17, 18-year-old, came back. If he goes back, he's going to have to establish himself, get in a team, get that street smarts that Cahill got when he was at Millwall before he went to Everton.
Now,
and that'll take time.
If the Asian Cup was the high point of football in this country for last year, where's the low point? Is it the Perth Glory salary cap scandal?
I think a lot of people in Western Australia would say that. I think the low point for me is that you had at the end of last season four clubs in the A-League up for sale and in serious financial difficulty. And that, to me, says that Mr. Lowy and John O'Neill got it horribly wrong with the franchise model. And I was talking again to somebody else who's looked at this, and he said the problem that was what they did was they looked at the J-League model when they set up the J-League. He goes, but what they didn't look at was that they changed the J-League model after about 8 years because it wasn't working. And that, I think, there's a lot of mistakes were made in the setting up of the A-League, and I think, to me, the big one was the franchise model. It has proved to be a failure. The owners are having to put a lot of money into it. Most of them don't have any knowledge of football, and they've employed people who have no knowledge of football. And if you look, there's no marketing now of the A-League whatsoever. Fox are the only people that actually do any advertising of the league. And I'm not, when I say marketing, not just putting your fixture, there's a game this weekend at NRB Stadium. That's not marketing. It's promoting players. It's promoting the club. And we don't see that anywhere at the moment. And the A-League's in a lot of trouble.
I must admit, I don't watch or the television news much anymore. I don't buy papers much anymore. As much as I like to, I like the old style, especially a broadsheet. I love a broadsheet. But online, there is no Glory. There is no A-League almost. A-League stories get buried in the online media press. I'm talking, you know, your Perth Nows, your West Australians, those sorts of
things. Well, there's two that don't actually have a single football writer on their staff. And again, if people want that to change, they need to hammer these websites and newspapers and just say, guys, don't. Whenever they write a stupid article, and to be honest, I don't read them because they do write ridiculous articles that are ill-informed and are either just propaganda or just complete rubbish. You know, people should say, look, get a football writer, someone who actually knows what's going on, because it's an insult to those who are fans. And I mean, that's probably why our website gets a lot of traction.
Listening to Eastern States Radio too, I mean, this Andy Kehoe story, you know, how are they going to sign him up? They've got these. I mean, you hear a different story about what the situation is from five different people. You've got five different stories. It can only be one story. It's either this or it's not this.
Yeah, I mean, it's a crazy situation. I mean, he will be playing. And the question is, though, who made the signing? Was it the coach? Was it the CEO? Or was it the owner? And from what I hear, once again, the coach should be the only person signing players. And I hear that wasn't the case on this.
If you're Kenny Lowe and Tony Sage comes to you and says, guess what, I've just signed Andy Keogh, what do you think? You think, oh, bloody great? Or do you go, oh, mate, how am I going to deal with this?
Oh, like it depends. I mean, Kenny Lowe would have set up the structure of his team to fit the players that he signed at the beginning of the season, and suddenly you're changing that, throwing another player in. Look, Andy Keogh did well last year, and everyone seems to think at the club that he is going to be the saviour. He is going to be the one who drives people through the gates. He's going to get the team back to playing attractive football. But it's the people behind him that have got to play the attractive football to get the ball to him to score the goals. It's a team game. It's not one player. But the other thing that they fail to realise is football fans hate players who abandon a club. And they hate players who abandon a club even more when they were involved in the scandal that caused the club not to make the finals, and that they left the club because they were offered a better financial deal overseas. And so Andy Keogh, in my opinion, and I think the fans are going to expect him, when he goes out on that pitch, he's going to have to score every game. If he goes in a barren patch, the fans will turn against him as well.
My only concern is that players start to believe the bullshit. I.e. that they start to believe this outside, Andy Keogh's going to save us stuff. When the players start believing that, that's downhill. They're going nowhere. If the players, I'm sure they probably do, realise that, we've got a lift as well. It's not just him coming in. And they have, in fairness to them, they have lifted in the last couple of weeks compared to their form earlier in the
young
season.
The young boys have played quite well. Still, they're very raw. But, I think there's been a lot of positive signs, a lot of the WA-grown players. And you sort of think, well, if you stick with them and you build for a couple of seasons, who knows, they could be good. But the key thing there, John, though, is at the moment, what nobody seems to realise is the fans are upset with what happened. The fans are holding Tony Sage accountable, and that is why they are not going to the games. And when you're getting crowds of 5,500... of which I've been advised that 1,400 were free tickets were given out for that game, and yet the club claim they've got 6,000 members, something's very, very wrong. Sure, the last game they reported a figure of 7,000. I was at that game. I have never seen the main stand so empty in any event I've ever gone to, except for probably a W League game. And I just think, I don't know, I don't believe that crowd figure personally. But that was the figure that was reported, so we have to take it as being gospel.
It'll be interesting to see how much the Premier League's decision to go with Optus in this country is going to affect the A-League, whether that is actually helpful for them, because people aren't going to, a lot of people have said, I'm not signing up to Optus just so I can watch the Premier League.
Well, there's a lot of people I know saying, are they going to get rid of their Fox and sign up to Optus because of that?
Yeah.
So I think it could go either way. The one thing I do think you're going to have a major problem is the best night for viewing the A-League on Fox was on a Saturday when it dovetailed into the English Premier League. The Friday night viewing figures are poor on SBS. They're really poor. They're poor on Fox. And the Sunday game figures, again, are not good. So that you're not getting the TV audience. So are Fox going to throw the money they threw at it last time? I don't think they are. I think the management's going to turn around and go, we've not got the English Premier League now. There's no way we can give you $40 million for the A-League. And David Gallop reckons he's going to get some of the $25 million that Fox paid for the EPL. I don't think that's going to happen. But the bigger story there, John, is for the English Premier League. And we've always said, how long can this bubble last? Two TV stations in Asia bid for the English Premier League TV rights. The English Premier League came back and said, you haven't bid enough. And they turned around and said, well, fine, we're not raising our bids because it's not viable for us as a television company. We cannot get more subscriptions and we cannot get more money for advertising. So that is the level we can go. So I believe in Malaysia and Singapore that next year there may be no Premier League coverage on TV in Malaysia and Singapore. Now, someone may come in at the last minute. They may lower, EPL may lower it because those are big markets for them. But it shows that the TV stations now cannot keep lifting the bar in terms of what they're paying for these sporting rights. And I think you're going to see that across the board.
Sooner or later, the players are going to have to take a cut.
Yeah.
I mean, the inflation rate in salaries for international footballers is just crazy. And if it keeps inflating the way it is, television stations just won't because they can't. No one will have the money.
Well, actually, John, that gives us a good lead into our first guest of 2016. And what some of our listeners may not be aware of is that the licensed players agents regulations with FIFA changed in 2015. and now you do not have to do some of the rigorous training that you had to do in the past. However, the Australian Football Agents Association, which was for those agents, has decided to stay together to try and remain as professional as you had to be and to have quality control on the way they operate. So I thought it would be very interesting to catch up with Peter Palaiologos, who is the head of that. He's the president of the Australian Football Agents Association, and hear some of his thoughts on what the changes mean and some of the pitfalls for parents to look out for if they have a talented player. Now, this is quite a long interview, and we're going to actually split it over two shows. Peter Palaiologos, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thank you, Ashley. It's good to be part of the show. Thanks for the invitation. And I hope you had a happy new year. And thank you for the opportunity to talk player agents and player intermediaries in Australia.
Now, looking forward to having a good chat with you. And I suppose the obvious question is, how did you become involved or what made you want to become a player agent? Because it's not an obvious pathway.
No, it's not. No, it's not an obvious pathway. My journey started, I was involved in, played football. And then what happened was I decided to be a referee. And I came through the ranks here in Victoria, in Melbourne, and also part of one of the committees and also on the Victorian State Committee. But then my eyesight went a little bit, and I'm not big on contact lenses, but I wanted to be involved in the sport. So two things. I was studied teaching and then law, and law obviously involves player contracts. Combine that with a passion for football. Also, teaching was about helping young people who've got aspirations, to assist them in their career path or their pathway. So that sort of came together, and I decided to sit an exam that was back then FIFA required an exam to be a licensed player agent, and the Football Federation of Australia undertook those exams. Are quite difficult. I sat that. Obviously, being a lawyer, that sort of helped me because quite a few questions are very technical. And then from there, organically, I slowly built my business. I worked with other player agents in Australia and overseas, and it sort of grew as the A-League grew. 10 years ago, the A-League, to now, right now, as a player agent or what we call a football intermediary, there's much more opportunities. And that's also with, that comes with obviously social media, the interest in the game, the growth in Asia. A lot of Australian players going to Europe and Asia. So, yeah, it's come a long way. But I think the last few years have been quite exciting. A lot of in football in Australia, and also for intermediaries or player agents.
You mentioned there that obviously FIFA required you sat an exam several years ago. That's changed now, hasn't it? But I believe that the Australian football agents have decided that they're still going to try and maintain the high standards that were there in the past.
Yes, we decided about 4 or 5 years ago, because as you will know, your listeners will know, obviously football agents, player agents haven't always had the best reputation, or it's not always the most glamorous, as we know with Jerry Maguire and all that sort of hype. But what we decided to do was, although we're all competitors, and it's a very, very competitive market for players, clubs, to form an association, and it's basically the Australian Football Agents Association. We're incorporated in Victoria, so we got rules, we've got membership. So most of the leading agents, we decided to form this association, so we can also engage as a stakeholder in Australia. So we can engage with the Football Federation Australia, the Players Union, which is the PFA, with clubs, so we can sort of deal with our issues, but also to regulate in the sense that we, with our members, we have a code. We've developed a code of conduct. We try to employ a professional indemnity insurance. Everyone has to have professional indemnity insurance. And then we also provide a lot of information to our members, because there's a lot of training information, whether that's provided by the FFA, a lot of circulars provided by FIFA on different areas like training compensation, which I'll probably go through a little bit later, regulations, what's happening in clubs, players are not being paid. So we do share a lot of information. So there's about 14 or 15 members. All the elite agents in Australia are members. We're obviously going to take on members, but we also have whoever wants to join us has to go for a little bit of not a due diligence, but we have to assess whether they're qualified because we're trying to maintain a standard. So sort of the goal there. But we've also focused on getting some memorandum understanding MOUs with the FFA and the PFA, which is in progress at the moment. We're going to hope to pursue that. So we really want to be a stakeholder in the Australian football, because there's one thing that, I mean, agents may not always get the best sort of rap, but I will say that we develop a lot of business. We provide young players with opportunities. We bring players from overseas into Australia. Marquees, some of our members have brought some big marquees, Del Piero, Dwight York. So I think we have a place in the football landscape, and we need to be organised. So that's why we've started the Football Agents Association, or AFA.
If we look at the changes that FIFA brought in and the sort of deregulation, excuse me, I mean, how has that changed? Because it appears that anyone could now say that they were a football agent. And to me, you're dealing with contracts, as you've touched on there. There's so much more to just literally trying to place a player at a club.
There is, I'm happy to... what I can do is I can identify the changes between what was the former FIFA regulations and what's happened in the new intermediary. So basically, now we're known as football intermediaries. Before, we were licensed football agents by your FA, FFA, but FIFA had a framework. Now it's more the national associations will regulate the intermediaries. But the changes have really been, there's no more license, so you don't sit in an exam anymore. Anyone can be an intermediary in a sense, a parent, a brother, anyone else who can obviously represent players, who can get a contract from a player, can and registers that contract, can be an intermediary. So it's really opened up this whole industry. No longer it's have professional indemnity insurance that there was under the FIFA regulations before. The new intermediary regulation, you don't need to have professional indemnity insurance, which is quite concerning, because if a player has a problem with an agent, they may want to take action. They can't claim against that insurance policy. Basically, agreements have changed. Before, you used to have a two-year contract between the player, a maximum between the player and the agent. Now, under the new regs, there's no limit like that. Some countries have employed it, but in Australia, we don't have a limit. So a young player who's aspiring may fall into a position where they sign an agreement for 5 years and then they're not happy with that intermediary. That's a bit of an issue that may arise now under the new regulations. That's quite concerning. Remuneration's changed. Before, now there is a recommendation that players pay around about 3%. That's just a recommendation. That is not prescriptive or conclusive. Minors, basically, minors in Australia, for instance, minors, people, players under 18 cannot be charged anymore, any fees, which is a very good, I think it's a good change. So anyone under 18, an agent or an intermediary cannot charge you for any services. And also another big change is companies. So basically with anyone who's a minor, so anyone under 18 cannot be charged or asked to be given money to an agent in relation to a contract, which is, I think, a very good rule that's been implemented. So basically, minors cannot be charged by agents or intermediaries. Another change is companies. Before, the old regulations, you had to be an individual, a person. You had professional indemnity insurance, you sat your exam, you had a code of conduct under the FFA, but now a company can register as intermediaries, so they can have 3 or 4 player agents or intermediaries working for them. Before, we never had that. That's quite a significant change. A few of the other changes, more the national association's more responsible for intermediaries. So there was before you would register with, say, in Australia, FFA, but you can actually practice in other parts, other countries, represent players in other countries. Now, if you want to do business as an intermediary, you obviously register in Australia, but if you want to do business in England or the Netherlands or France or China, you need to register your transaction or your deal in those countries. So it's a little, it's much more work for intermediaries now, because each national association you deal with to do a player transaction, you have to register. So it's quite cumbersome right now. The other change is, and this is the biggest change I would say, is the onus. The onus has shifted. What I mean is the responsibility has shifted from the agents to the players and clubs. Players and clubs now are responsible for their agents or intermediaries to do the right thing, in the sense that they register the agreement, make sure the intermediary's got the right paperwork and all that. So it's very important now that players and even parents and also clubs understand that the intermediary or agent they're dealing with is doing the right thing and all the paperwork's in place, because the way the new regulations are sort of worded, or the focus, it's the onus or the responsibility is on the players, not as before or so much on the intermediary or the agent. That's quite a big change.
That's huge, Peter, because to me, really, for a parent of a child who doesn't really understand the game, then this is where they need to go with somebody who knows what they're doing, or they could actually undo the talent that that player has. And I'd just like to go back to one of the points you made, how, you know, under 18 players can't be signed by an intermediary, or they can't be, sorry, charged. There should be no charges. Yeah. What happens, for example, if there is some unscrupulous person who decides to charge a player or the parents of a player who's under 18? Where does that parent go to sort of lodge a complaint?
Oh, basically, the complaint will be lodged with, for instance, in Australia, with the FFA. We're a bit lucky in Australia that the FFA has sort of allowed for a grievance procedure. There's a grievance procedure in place, and that intermediaries are still part of that, as are the players and clubs, and that can be lodged that way. In a lot of countries, what's happened is there's been changes where that before you used to have dispute resolution or the National Association or even FIFA looking at these things. In Australia, we're quite lucky that you can lodge a complaint with the FFA. Also, we've, as an association, we've engaged with the FFA about the rules. We actually think that the rules here in Australia, which are the basic minimum rules that I've just sort of went through, like, for example, you don't have to have professional indemnity insurance. We're also about training intermediaries, continuing training. We're sort of trying to engage with FFA about that to make sure that they do bring a rule where agents have professional indemnity insurance, that there's compulsory training. But one thing the FFA has stipulated to us, any contract we lodge with an underrating, so once you do a deal or a transaction, you have to lodge that contract with the FFA. And that, if the player is under 18, there has to be a clause in that contract, and this is the protection for under 18 players and parents, that says that the intermediary cannot be paid any fees as long as the player is under 18 or a minor. So I think that's the protection there. So
yeah,
as long as parents are aware that if they sign a contract, that clause is there. However worded, we've got a standard wording for it, but there's a lot of intermediaries who aren't our members that it says as long as you're under 18, you do not have to pay the intermediary. And that clause, that contract has to be lodged with the FFA. And if it's not there, because the FFA will check it, see the date of birth, they will see this is obviously for more professional players or youth players, you know, in the A-League, of course, there's incidents where this doesn't happen. They will check that. And if they don't see that clause, they will return the contract or ask the intermediary to insert that clause for an under 18 player. That's the process that we understand. So that is good protection for Australia.
Hi, I'm Zocco Kalitz, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, that was half of the interview with Peter Palaiologos. from the Australian Football Agents Association. We'll be playing the second half of that in our next podcast. So if you enjoyed that and you found it was educational, please make sure you listen to the second part of our podcast, because there is some really, really good information in there, and we will be speaking with Peter again.
Now that we're educational, can we get some sort of government subsidy or something?
Well, that would be nice. And of course, well, if there's anybody out there wants to put an advert inside our podcast, we're more than happy to hear from you.
Absolutely. Cha-ching.
Yep.
Before we go, just a quick look, congratulations to the West Australian Cricket for their last season too. We're mentioning things for the last season, last year, and they, after years perhaps of in the doldrums, you know, they've come back. They won the one-day title last year, got to the Shield final. Justin Langer's obviously a coach that players play for and believe in, and he's got a big future ahead of him, you'd suggest.
He has, and I think absolutely well done to him. I hear that he is already being spoken to as to whether he might be interested in being the next Australian cricket coach.
See, that staggers me that that sort of discussion would be public, while you've got a guy like Darren Lehman in there who's doing...
I think it's disgraceful. Darren Lehman still has the job. You should not be talking to anybody until he's... You've decided as Cricket Australia and told him that you're not renewing his contract, or he has said, I don't want the job when my contract expires.
That given...
Which may have happened. We don't know.
We don't know. I mean, this story really came about because Darren Lehman is standing aside for the tour to the West Indies, and Justin Langer is going to take over when he goes there. But it's just filling in. It's not...
But know, but I actually think, to be fair, I think that's actually not a bad idea. Because if you look, hockey's been doing that for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Graham Reed, the current Kookaburras coach, coached the Champions Trophy when Rick Charlesworth was the head coach, and also the Oceania Cup. If you look this time, Paul Gadoin was in charge at the Oceania Cup, who's Graham Reed's assistant. And it's a good way of seeing how these guys go and a passing of the baton if you want to change your coach. So I think there's a lot of merit in that. We should also congratulate the Wildcats, who again, as they do every year, made the finals and had
phenomenal.
An outstanding year.
They would have to be the best run sporting organisation in this state, hands down.
No argument from me. Well, that's it for our first podcast of 2016, but make sure you tune into the second, where we'll have the second part of the interview from this show.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.